You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
Hey, hello. I'm like in your brain or in by your ears. This is just a note to say that the podcast you're about to listen to is brought to you by the dudes at Motorola. Okay, enjoy, dude.
Hi, Shane. How you doing tonight?
Doing good, Rod. How are you?
I'm just wonderful. And this is going to be our fourth show of the Atomic Show.
Awesome. The more shows, the merrier.
Yeah, it's actually been kind of fun. And tonight I think I want to talk a little bit about peak oil and some of the possible solutions to that issue.
It might be good to start off with a definition of what the peak oil phenomenon is for our readers who might, or our listeners who might not have heard of it before. It's not exactly making the nightly news, but it's definitely showing up on many, many blogs and podcasts online. So,
it's definitely a topic for us energy geeks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's definitely making the rounds in the energy circles. So, the term peak oil was defined by a petroleum engineer by the name of M. King Hubbard back in the 50s and 60s. And a student of his named Ken DeFeas, you were telling me that you had, I sent you a link to his blog and you got a chance to look at it. And it's some seriously jolly reading, and I say that in the most sarcastic tone I can possibly muster.
Yeah, I kind of like driving around. I'm not real happy about the idea that oil and gas are just going to get more and more expensive.
Although there is, at least the peak oil people seem, even though they don't realize it, they're providing us the tools to get away from the stranglehold that oil and natural gas have on our economy.
Well, I sure hope
it's
so.
A relatively gradual process where it will slowly increase in price and provide stronger and stronger price signals, and eventually at some point the crossover point will happen if it hasn't happened already. And I think it has happened already, but it's just going to get better and better and better.
So this guy Hubbard, he made his predictions back in the 50s. Is there any evidence that shows that he was right?
There's quite a bit of evidence, and there is, this evidence is detailed in both books of his student, Ken DeFeas. Second book is the one I happen to have on my bookshelf, and I'm looking at it right now. It's called Beyond Oil. And there was another book that he wrote. I believe it was called The View from Hubbard's Peak. No, actually, The View from Hubbard's Peak is a subtitle on Beyond Oil. And I'm staring at it now, and it's got all kinds of blurbs on the back. And the evidence that he provides is largely statistical, where he basically looked at all the numbers of all the discoveries and production statistics and the state of the industry over the course of decades. And the numbers that he's seeing seem to indicate that as time has gone on, fewer and fewer and fewer discoveries are being made, and the rate of increase of oil production from even the very large fields like Ghawar in Saudi Arabia, which is the world's largest, is getting slower and slower. Add to that, what now?
I just was going to say, and this Ghawar thing is pretty amazing. That is a huge, giant oil well. I think it produces something on the order of 4 million barrels a day, which is about 40% of Saudi's production. And it's been in operation since about 1935.
Very, very large lake of oil into which the way I've heard it visualized is, imagine a mid-sized United State in the United States under which the entire state is one massive oil field. And they only realized when they started looking at the chemistry of the oil coming up that all the chemistry and all the isotopics of the oil were exactly the same in all these wells that were dug many, many dozens to hundreds of miles apart. Incidentally, for those listeners who are interested in learning more about this, it's spelled G-H-A-W-A-R. If you just type that into any search engine, it'll provide you all the information you could possibly ask for, you know, on the statistics of this field. And it is, like Rod said, it is amazing that this field has produced as much oil as it has in just one body of oil.
I've been reading a lot of kind of scary things about guar. One of the things that seems to be happening is that the oil that's coming out of that field is becoming more and more water mixed in with the oil.
Yeah, so the question becomes, how much of that water is showing up because they're overproducing the field, and how much of it might be because of enhanced recovery techniques that they're using? So, and how much of it might be the enhanced recovery techniques that they're using actually causing the field to be able to produce less and less? That's another, that brings up another person that you posted about on your blog, and I've done some independent reading on him. The name of Ron Cook. He runs a website or a blog called The Cultural Economist, which is tceconomist.blogspot.com. And he has a lot of similar statistics to Ken DeFay's that seem to indicate that peak oil is a phenomenon that people should take very seriously. And one of the most important things that I've seen him mention in his articles is the evidence that he provides that the major oil producers have overstated their reserves, which is, frankly, kind of frightening.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing. When you look at the history of the reserve numbers, it seems like throughout the 1980s and 90s, no matter how much oil these guys were producing, every year the reserve numbers kept going up, yet there were no real big announced finds. It just seemed like they just kept saying there's more and more oil there than we thought there was.
Trying
the motivation for doing that is pretty obvious.
Oh, yeah. But unfortunately for them, there are some of us who can balance a control volume.
Balance a control volume? What does that mean?
Well, I think in terms of engineering, we like to think of things in terms of black boxes to keep the math simple, like assume the horse to be a sphere to make the math easier and things like that. And one of the things that I learned about in engineering as an undergrad was a concept called control volume analysis, where you draw an imaginary box around whatever complicated system with billions and billions of parts. However many parts it has, you just draw an imaginary box around it, and you sum what's going in minus what's coming out and form a variable out of that that states it's either constant, it's going up, or it's going down. So by inflating their numbers of their reserve numbers, they're saying that the source term inside the box that we can't see, which is apparently this oil that's bubbling up, is larger than we have any right to expect because we're not seeing any new discoveries. There's only a finite amount of the stuff. And we can the nice thing with peak oil is that means that it'll get more and more expensive gradually. It's not going to be a situation where we wake up one day and the price of oil goes up like 20 times all at once. It'll be a slow, gradual process.
Well, one of the things that is pretty obvious to me if you look over the pattern of oil prices over the last century, it is a very spiky pattern. People get all excited, the price goes up much faster than anybody would have predicted. And then, of course, the law of supply and demand kicks in, and the high prices reduce the demand. They don't necessarily increase the supply very much, although some people think that, you know, because you have higher prices, that it'll all of a sudden be a bunch more production, but they certainly do knock down the demand.
It's an interesting statistic about that that our listeners may not know, is that everyone likes to claim, or everyone likes to quote, rather, it is a fact that the last nuclear power plant was ordered in this country, in the United States, in the early 70s. What people don't know is that's also when the last oil refinery was ordered. So all the oil refineries that we have that are producing at maximum production, and they have absolutely no margin, are all early 70s or older technology.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, one of the things people don't seem to understand is that there's certainly a proven benefit to the producers for there to be a tight supply-demand balance. They like to run those plants at full power.
It reduces the latency between when the price goes up and when they can get a return on their investment. It reduces the slack in the system.
I was reading the other day that the major oil companies right now in their capital investment budgets for looking for oil, they need to, well, they make the assumption that oil is going to cost somewhere around $40 a barrel, which keeps them from drilling or producing in areas where they probably could still produce and make money. But that helps to keep the price up because the less they produce, the tighter the supply-demand curve is. Actually, I guess in many ways that's probably a good thing because I like the idea of stretching out what supplies we have. But one of the things that amazed me when I read DeFay's blog entry regarding peak oil is he's totally dismissive of the capabilities of nuclear power to do anything about providing an alternative.
Because you thinking that? Of nuclear power in terms of large, centralized submarine engines that have been scaled up way too many orders of magnitude to be inexpensive, like oil is inexpensive or it used to be inexpensive.
I've done some calculations, and I think that it's a pretty good rule of thumb that you can, if you take a 1,000-megawatt reactor, you can consider that to be equivalent to a 40,000 barrel per day oil well in terms of energy production.
Mm-hmm. Are there any oil wells that produce that or more?
Oh, yeah. There's lots of oil wells that produce more than 40,000 barrels per day. Or I shouldn't say oil wells, but oil fields that produce that. As we
I just
said,
remember, I'm familiar with the oil fields around in Mississippi. This is something that people don't know is that as you drive around in Mississippi, there are some places in the state where you'll be driving along and you'll see the telltale sign. You'll see this oil rig just bobbing like a dunking bird, and it's got like half a dozen barrels out there that produces like a barrel and like a few barrels a day, and they're just very, very small production. They're just farmers who bought these oil wells from the original developers, and they still produce enough to justify keeping the machinery running, but nothing anywhere close to that kind of magnitude.
Yeah,
but those are the only ones I've ever seen. So,
well, those are the stripper wells, and of course, yeah, you know, like you said, the stripper wells often are in the single digits of barrels per day, but hopefully a nuclear power plant will be able to significantly overcome that kind of production, and they do. Now, 40,000 barrels a day, let's assume that the price is $60 per barrel, which is a reasonable assumption for today. That's about $2.4 million worth of energy every day. And interestingly enough, the fuel for that nuclear power plant costs somewhere on the order of $100,000 per day. Not a bad rate of return.
Impressive. And that's with today's burn-up rates, right? That's with 3% burn-up, or is that assuming 100%?
No, that's today's burn-up rate. That's the cost that the utilities report. I think they report, according to data I read in the Nuclear Energy Institute not too long ago, 2004, which was the last year they had data for, was 0.4 cents per kilowatt hour. Or a nuclear power plant.
Nuclear power plants are money trees, or nearest things as anyone has ever seen to them.
That was a quote that came out of a New Jersey newspaper not too long ago in discussions about a purchase by Exelon of public service electric and gas. I love that quote. Someday I'd like to shake some money trees.
It would be cool. But
hey, you know,
go ahead.
Sometimes we talk over each other. That's one of the problems with voiceover IP.
You had something to say, or
who, me? I forgot whatever I was going to say.
Well, I was going to return to Ken DeFeo's negative opinions on nuclear, and that exact attitude that you're talking about is echoed in his book. I mean, he has a whole chapter that he devotes to uranium, which is not as negative as some people, but it's he doesn't see uranium there's an economic term, substitutable for oil. He only sees it as a way of producing electricity rather than as a prime mover.
And you know, I've seen that attitude or that comment so many times, and I don't understand it, particularly since my perspective is not as the operator of a commercial nuclear power plant. The engines that I used to operate as the chief engineer were on board submarines, and of course the engines that were replaced by nuclear power plants on submarines used to be diesels. Obviously not directly in the same ship, but you know, before nukes we had diesel submarines, and before nuclear powered aircraft carriers we had oil burning aircraft carriers. So it's pretty obvious that you can directly replace oil burning with uranium burning in some applications. The enormous icebreakers.
Yeah, where your size issues and shielding are more fall into the noise when you're comparing it to the size of the vehicle.
Right. And for large commercial ships, those guys burn an awful lot of oil, especially if they're trying to go fast. When you're talking about propulsion on board on the water, in order to double your speed, you have to have
eight times
as much power.
It goes as the cube.
Right, and if you need eight times as much power to double your speed, that means you burn eight times as much fuel.
So that brings me to another question. I've seen these numbers, but I know you've looked at the numbers more closely. What percentage of the transportation fuel demand in the United States is used by vehicles as large or larger than, say, a tractor trailer?
I believe it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 40% of the transportation fuel is used in large vehicles, and transportation is about one-third of the total energy use in the U.S. Usually you can split it up pretty much one-third transportation, one-third commercial/industrial, and one-third residential.
So I wonder what would happen to the cost of oil. This is the engineer playing simple mathematical games. Just for the sake of argument, if you could replace everything north of that particular engine size, that 40% of the oil, I could work out the numbers, but it's been a long day. That would impact the cost of fuel somewhat significantly and bring it down a bit.
Well, one of the things that is pretty obvious, if you look at the oil markets and track them over time, you'll find that tight supply demand balance, which results in fairly immediate price signals on the upside, also results in fairly quick price signals on the downside. And that, what I mean is that it doesn't take too much extra production every day before what used to be a shortage turns into a glut. And the reason for that is we consume something on the order of 80 million barrels of oil a day in the world. And if we just had a 1% plus side, in other words, 1% supply greater than demand, you'd end up with an extra million barrels of oil a day that you have to store. And it doesn't take too long to start filling up all the reservoirs for above ground storage of the oil at 1 million barrels a day. Pretty soon,
the fluxes are so huge that if there's any imbalance at all, it shows up in the form of either giant shortages or giant gluts very quickly.
Of course, there is an organization that works very, very hard to try to keep all that in balance, known as the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, otherwise known as OPEC. So they usually meet together every 3 months or so, and we'll definitely start throttling down the supply if the demand starts going away. And I always point back to a event that happened almost exactly 50 years ago. 1956, there was an oil crisis when it was a Suez Canal controversy. I believe that the Egyptians said they were going to take over the canal and the...
they wanted to nationalize it, I think.
Exactly. The French and the British decided they'd go in and assert their ability to go through the canal. And there was some threats made about reducing the export of oil. Even back in 56, that was viewed as a significant threat. And the U.S. president, who was Dwight Eisenhower at the time, sent over an emissary to talk to King Saud of Saudi Arabia.
This is Anderson, wasn't it?
That's it. That's what I did. Did I say Anderson?
Yeah.
I meant to say Anderson. But he told King Saud back in 1956 that we really didn't need their oil because we had this new thing called nuclear power.
But there's a catch to the story.
Well, the catch to the story was the Saudi prince or Saudi king just said, I hear there's some problems with that nuclear stuff, so you'll still need our oil for a while.
Well, there was also the catch that the ambassador might have had another set of motivations and not exactly impressing the message that he was told to send as strongly as he might have otherwise done.
You mean because he happened to be an oil guy himself?
Yes.
Money. Yeah, it's pretty hard to separate your personal desires from your professional desires sometimes. One of the things that's happening today is that there's a growing recognition, even among people like the oil men in the White House, that nuclear power may have a role to play in reducing our addiction to fossil fuels. And I was actually quite happy to listen to his weekly radio address. It was produced on the 18th. I think that was on Saturday. And he spent a lot of time talking about how he thought that nuclear energy, if properly handled, could go a long way in reducing use of fossil fuels. And he made another announcement about a program that had been announced earlier that said that the U.S. is joining with a global nuclear energy partnership. And one of the things that really was nice to hear was he said that he liked the idea of producing some smaller reactors for developing countries.
Incidentally, that smaller reactor for developing countries market was the exact same market that Edward Teller's underground reactor design that I mentioned last week was developed to address back in the mid-90s. And they ran their numbers with that, with the natural gas price, to be competitive against combined cycle natural gas power with the price of gas that was going at the time in 1996. And I can only imagine that the numbers look much better now, especially if you have this hermetically sealed package that comes in on a tractor trailer or ship or whatever that you plug into place like a giant AA battery. And you just run it for 30 years, and then at the end of 30 years, the same company who sold it to you comes and picks it up.
Well, that's definitely an interesting design philosophy. The price of natural gas in 1996, based on a very clear memory of that year, was about $1.80 per million BTUs. I remember that because at the time I was working very hard to persuade people to listen to my story about closed cycle nuclear gas turbines that were designed to be competitive with combined cycle gas plants. And nobody really wanted to listen when gas costs $1.80 per million BTUs. Right now it's fallen back a bit from its peaks in the summer. I think it's running at about $7 per million BTUs. And since the price of fuel is about 90% of the price of electricity from a natural gas plant, that's pretty expensive stuff.
And once again, the Atomic Show ends without a smooth transition. Someday I will make sure that my processor and everything is set up properly so that GarageBand will record as long as we want to talk. But for now, that was it. Atomic Show number 4 is in the can, and Shane and I will be talking to you again soon. Keep thinking about energy. Keep thinking about solutions. Go green. Go atomic. If you'd like to learn more about atomic energy and energy in general, please come and visit Atomic Insights at www.atomicinsights.com or visit the blog for regular updates at www.atomicinsights.blogspot.com. And if you want to listen to some great advice on how to be a better manager, visit my friend Wayne Trammell at the Cranky Middle Manager Show. Listen to this promo.
Hey, it's Wayne Trammell, host of the Cranky Middle Manager Show. And if you can pull yourself away from the donuts in the break room long enough to listen, I'd sure appreciate it. The Cranky Middle Manager Show on Podcast Network. We have interviews, the classic quote of the week, and, of course, the most honest take on the life of those of us who toil in the honest, hard-working world of middle management. That's the Cranky Middle Manager Show on the Podcast Network. I haven't had this much fun since I found out 360-degree feedback really was anonymous.
This podcast was brought to you by Motorola.